The Caspian region in Central Asia is the source of the world's largest remaining untapped oil reserve. It's estimated to range from 50 billion to 200 billion barrels of oil. That's almost as much as can be found in Saudi Arabia. It's worth, at current prices, approximately $4 trillion. And that's not all. Other parts of the region are rich in natural gas. Ever since the 19th century, developed nations have battled to gain access and control over the Caspian riches. Now Russia, Britain, China, Turkey, Pakistan, and the U.S. are vying for these resources. In his new book, The New Great Game, journalist Lutz Klevemann lays out the impact that this oil rush has had on the former Soviet republics, which ring the Caspian Sea, and the implications it holds for foreign policy. I want to talk about some of the countries you traveled through, and you write very convincingly about how the presence of oil pervades daily life in some of these lands. I'd like to start with Azerbaijan's capital, Baku. You describe it as part museum and part boomtown. What's it like?
Azerbaijan is really a banana republic. It's a country, again, that's been independent for the past 10 years, run by a former KGB general, former communist, former member of the Politburo, Gaider Aliyev, who's just passed on the crown, as it were, to his son, Ilham Aliyev. And then you have Baku, which is really the oil town par excellence. They had an oil boom there about 100 years ago. That's really where most of the oil at the time came from on the world markets. And now you have this new oil boom. You have a very glitzy sort of new town, and then you have, sadly, quite a bit of poverty. And that's what you will find in all these countries, that the oil wealth for the common people is more of a curse than a blessing, because very little of the profits trickle down to the people in the street. And you will find this in all the countries in the region and outside of the region, except perhaps in Norway and in the UK. Oil wealth leads essentially to corruption. It leads to economic decline because the countries rely on nothing but oil. It leads to political instability. It leads to political crisis, to coup d'etats, to putsches. And then ultimately it leads to bloody civil wars.
Turkmenistan is another player in this oil rush. And it sounds what you're describing in the region is a kind of an oil grab or a wild west that's growing up on the basis of this industry. In the case of Turkmenistan, you refer to it as the new Kuwait. It's the top 10 natural gas reserves in the world. And it's ruled by a man whom one diplomat you talked to compared to Kim Il-sung of North Korea, only a lot weirder. What is the story there?
Turkmenistan, believe you me, is the weirdest and the most surreal place in all of Central Asia. And there's no poverty of such surreal places, let me tell you. It's the one place where a taxi ride to the airport is more expensive than the flight itself. And this is a flight on a brand new Boeing 757. And that's because such flights are heavily subsidized. Now, the government can only do that because it gets so much money from all these oil reserves. And it's run by an eccentric dictator who calls himself Turkmenbashi, the leader of all Turkmens. And he has these golden statues of himself erected all over the capital, Ashgabat. You get to the capital, and I will never forget the first time I drove in. What you see is a golden statue on top of a column about 220 feet tall. Arms stretched out, the coat sort of billowing in the wind, and he rotates. So his face will always face the sun. This is how weird it gets down there.
What's the status of the oil industry in the Caspian region right now? What phase is it in?
Western oil companies have invested about $30, $40 billion into new production facilities, mainly in Azerbaijan and in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan particularly is very interesting because that's where they discovered just 2 or 3 years ago this huge Kashagan oil field, which may contain as much as 30 billion barrels of oil and thereby would rank among the 5 largest oil fields in the world. So you've got ExxonMobil, you've got Chevron Texaco playing in Kazakhstan. And it's at a sort of middle stage right now. It's not early days anymore. The oil fields have all been discovered, most of them. Concessions have been given away, and drilling has started, especially off the coast of Azerbaijan.
And what pipelines are in the process of being constructed now?
The major pipeline under construction at the moment is the pipeline that runs from Baku through Georgia all the way down to the Mediterranean port of Ceyhan in Turkey. That's a massive pipeline, about 1,100 miles of steel, construction costs of $4 billion, and all kinds of environmental, social, and political problems involved in it. The main operator of that pipeline is British Petroleum, and they can count on the firm political support from the Bush administration. And in fact, the World Bank and the European Bank of Reconstruction have just green-lighted loans to given to British Petroleum, causing protests from environmental groups and human rights groups in the region.
How crucial is the Caspian to U.S. energy policy, and what has Washington indicated about how it sees the Caspian reserves fitting into long-term energy policies?
The Caspian oil has become practically overnight very, very important to America because it could be an alternative to Saudi oil, to oil from that very unstable Middle East. Because the Middle East is still the biggest gas station in the world, and it always will be. It sits on two-thirds of the oil reserves. But it is a gas station where the gas is leaking and people are running around throwing matches. I mean, look at the terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia the other day. This is a very serious problem. Just imagine these Islamic fundamentalists would overthrow the corrupt House of Saud and would then stop the flow of oil to what they consider to be Western infidels. Just imagine 8 million barrels of oil vanishing from the world market practically overnight. It would be disastrous.
What evidence is there of U.S. interests in Caspian oil, and does it extend beyond before the present administration?
Oh, even under the Clinton administration, America discovered the Caspian as a strategically important region, and many of these pipeline projects, including the one going through Afghanistan, were invented, as it were, and supported under the Clinton administration. Now, what is new, though, with the Bush administration, quite apart from the well-known ties that this administration has with Texan big oil, is the Cheney Report. That was published in May 2001, before 9/11, and it analyzes the situation that the United States is in, which is quite dire in the sense that this country has to import two-thirds of all the gas it burns. I mean, think about it. One out of every 7 barrels of oil produced in the world is consumed on American highways. This country is very much addicted to oil. It's very much dependent on oil. So, departing from that analysis, Cheney and the other authors of the so-called Cheney Report suggested that the president make energy policy a part, an essential part of foreign policy. And the Cheney Report singles out the Caspian as a particularly important region in order to diversify America's oil supply, in order to reduce America's dependence on Saudi oil, on OPEC, essentially.
Well, you describe in the book how Washington is wooing these Caspian rulers, and one you write about is Karimov, and he's an ex-communist ruler of Uzbekistan. What is his human rights record, and what are Washington's dealings with Karimov's regime?
Oh, the human rights record is atrocious. It's one of these very unholy alliances. Islam Karimov, again, a former communist, a former top communist in the Soviet Union, is one of the worst dictators, probably every bit as bad as Saddam Hussein. I mean, we're looking at a regime where opponents get boiled to death. Now, the State Department quite publicly admits that torture is used on a regular basis in Uzbekistan. And I spend a couple of weeks in that country. It's a horrifying experience. There are tens of thousands of people languishing in these torture prisons in Uzbekistan. And the State Department openly admits that. And at the same time, this government last year paid $500 million to the regime of Uzbekistan, partly because it allows American troops to be stationed on Uzbek soil. And much of that money goes to the Uzbek security forces. And I met this one chap, Ahmed, who'd just been released from prison after 3 years, and he said, the guards beat me every day. And I asked, well, aren't you happy about American troops now being stationed in your country? And he said, why would I be? They're not doing anything for me. They're supporting the very government that suppresses me. So if the United States government is seen, as it is, sadly, as supporting these authoritarian regimes, then the anger is directed against the United States. So here we have the lack of democracy, as in the Middle East, the lack of democracy being the root cause of terrorism.
It's difficult to unravel anti-terror policy from oil policy. How do you begin to go about that?
I think what I've discovered in the course of my research and my travels and my interviews, that is, you will not understand the war on terror, you will not understand terror without knowing oil politics, because they are so closely intertwined. Time and again, I would try and find answers to the essential question of our time. What makes a man a terrorist? Why are they so angry? Why do they hate us so much? And it has a lot to do with what is perceived to be energy imperialism in the region. You know, these are people who are disenfranchised, they feel humiliated. It's not necessarily a material poverty, even though that plays a big role, but it's a sort of, as Friedman would say, a poverty of dignity, a lack of dignity. Let me give you one example. In Azerbaijan, 3 weeks ago, we had this election where Gaider Aliyev basically handed over the power to his son, some sort of casino gambler. And there were protests in the street, demonstrators came out. And this new baby dictator sent out the troops, sent out his security forces, and crushed these demonstrations quite brutally, arrested everyone, a couple of people got killed. And then the next day, you have Richard Armitage, the Undersecretary of State, calling up this new baby dictator and congratulating him on his electoral victory, on his, I quote, strong showing. Now, the next time somebody wonders why they hate us so much out there, this telephone conversation does give some indication why they do.
Well, you talk to many U.S. oil executives, also policymakers in Washington. How sensitive are they to these realities?
I've spoken to a number of decision makers in Washington and obviously the ambassadors in the region. And time and again, what I've found was there is the awareness of the nefarious consequences of this oil grab, as it were. This awareness just isn't there sometimes. It's lacking from the Beltway perspective. I mean, all these very glib and eloquent politicians talking about securing oil and making sure that it gets to the markets, that all sounds very well, but there is very little knowledge of what oil wealth in the region actually means. And it means that for most of the people in the region, it is a curse. It's not a blessing.
I don't mean to sound cynical or heartless, but hasn't it always been the case that U.S. corporations have had to do business with repressive regimes?
I mean, if you look back into the history of oil politics in the past couple of decades, yes, what you will find is American and other Western oil companies dealing with very unsavory regimes. And sometimes they weren't unsavory and undemocratic to begin with. But obviously, the profits that come with oil wealth make the political spoils so much more valuable. So people begin to wonder, well, maybe I should be in politics myself. And then you have all these struggles, and the people who usually come out on top of these struggles are dictators and military rulers. And then you have to deal with them. This is what's happening in Nigeria, or was happening until a few years ago. And I've reported on those oil conflicts in Nigeria. And it's what's happening in Venezuela, for example, where you have Hugo Chavez, who's obviously not an ideal ruler, at least in Washington's eyes. Now, what has changed, though, is that there is much more of an awareness now of corporate responsibility. Oil companies are now expected to do good for the communities in which they operate. This is why Shell in Nigeria, for example, is spending quite a bit of money now to build hospitals, to build schools in the Niger Delta, because people are watching what they're doing. Now, this is so far missing in Central Asia.
Well, in order to protect American business interests, likewise, the U.S. government has always had to accept relations with repressive regimes.
Well, absolutely. I mean, basically what's been happening in the Middle East for the past six decades, really, is the American government treating all these dictatorial regimes as one big dumb gas station, basically being indifferent to how they treat their own people as long as they keep the oil flowing. And that has been a fairly sensible policy from a realpolitik standpoint. But now, of course, since 9/11, when, as you will recall, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens, there is more of an awareness that this kind of cynical, I should say, policy can backfire and can affect us quite terribly in America. So there is more pressure now. And this is what I'm hoping to add to in my book, on the US government to become aware of the effects this sort of indifferent policy has in the countries, which is to create anger, create resentment, and create a lot of angry young men out there who could one day come over here and cause tremendous harm.
Journalist Lutz Klevemann, his new book is The New Great Game.